here at Paternal Heights Presbyterian Church in the beautiful, lovely blue skies and beautiful trees in Kingsport, Tennessee. The fall is just gloriously beautiful here. And last night I actually got some pictures of the sun setting in my backyard. The sun shines over the trees and hits the trees and the cow pasture. It's just so beautiful. It's just an amazing display of the glory of the triune God. And it's just an amazing thing to see. So I wanted to press on today in my study of John Brown of Haddington, of his great book, Counsel to Gospel Ministers. And I want to pull this up here and read it with you. Oops, that's letter one, letter two, and comment on along the way here. And hopefully, if you have a screen that's big enough, you can see the text here. Letter number two of Counsel to Gospel Ministers. And I'm reading this because this is a guy that lived back in the 18th century, in the 1700s. And this is an individual who really understood the gospel and understood the ways in which people can get it wrong and understood the things that need to be clear in your gospel proclamation. And if you're not clear on these things, you are, for all intents and purposes, useless to God as a minister of the gospel. And since there are seminary students here at the church that are studying for gospel ministry, and because I myself am a minister of the gospel, and I took ordination vows to preach, teach, and defend the gospel in public and private, and all my written correspondence and everything else, it's very important to me. There is a lot of defection going on today from the biblical gospel. There's a lot of hesitation on the part of people who should not be hesitant to recognize and to condemn falsehood. And so I wanted to go back a few centuries before our time, to someone who understood the gospel, and notice what he says about what you need to make clear to make sure you preach the gospel accurately. So here's letter number two. Dear sir, in addition to the cautions given in my former letter, I would say to you that you should beware of ever envying or grieving at the dignity, fame, prosperity, or usefulness of others. That's a big problem among us. We tend to really admire certain people to the point of almost idolizing them. You know, Martin Lloyd-Jones is someone I've always enjoyed listening to over the years. He's a wonderful preacher. There's other individuals that whose prowess in the pulpit I've admired greatly and have benefited from. Dale Ralph Davis was a guy I was introduced to when I was in seminary in Mississippi. And he's not nearly as well known as he should be, but I think, from what I have heard, he doesn't care, because it's not about being well-known. It's about being faithful to your charge in your local church and making sure that the people there get the gospel and that they get the whole counsel of God and that you exposit the text and that you're clear in what you're trying to say. And so this guy, John Brown of Haddington, a man who understood the gospel very well and had students and younger ministers that he wrote these letters to, he's telling them, beware of envying, grieving at the dignity, fame, prosperity, or usefulness of others. You don't want to do that. You need to understand that God gifted you in such a way as to make you useful for the station to which he would call you. And if that means that you're more well-known or that you write books and are published and have lots of people that are clamoring for your great wisdom, well, that's nice. I hope that doesn't go to your head. If not, it doesn't matter. What matters is that you, young man, and even, you know, forget gospel ministers. This is counsel to Christians in general. That counts for Christians in general. Don't worry about it. You walk closely with the Lord Jesus Christ. You be faithful in your calling. If you're married, make sure that you adore that wife that God gave you, and you love her and love your children, and you stick to your guns. I'm going to sneeze. Excuse me. Sorry about that. Don't worry about the usefulness of others. You walk closely with the Lord. Now, he continues here. Such a temper or conduct proceeds from pride, which is the leading lineament of the devil's countenance. It marks men's ignorance and hinders them from being edified by the gifts of others. It marks either the want or weakness of grace. It is contrary to all Christian love to God or men. It hinders our making the glory of God our chief end and blasphemes him as if he had no right to distribute his own gifts and grace or had not skill or equity to do it aright. So it's one thing to admire the gifts of others. It's another thing to envy them. It's another thing to kind of resent the usefulness of someone else. And that's very dangerous. That's pride. It hinders thankfulness to Him and contentment with our own condition and tends to murder both our soul and body. It appears most unreasonable when we seriously consider that it is not the measure of our gifts, but our faithful improvement of them that avails before God. That in many cases and circumstances, inferior endowments are most adapted to usefulness, as iron, in many cases, is more useful than gold. Isn't that, he's exactly right. Sometimes you wouldn't be as useful to God if you were more gifted at oration, more gifted in your theological acumen and your ability to remember everything that you read, and that sort of thing. Listen to that again. It appears most unreasonable when we seriously consider that it is not the measure of our gifts, but our faithful improvement of them that avails before God. What he's saying is that, you know, we had nothing to do with the gifts that we were given. What we need to focus on is making the best of the gifts we have been given. Don't worry about what gifts God gave someone else. He gave you the gifts you have. You work with those gifts and try to develop them as best you can to make yourself the most useful to God. He says that in many cases and circumstances, inferior endowments are most adapted to usefulness, as iron in many cases is more useful than gold. That God will call us to account for no more gifts than he bestows upon us. That many others have smaller measures of gifts, that God is under obligation to none and may do with his own what he pleases, and that great gifts exposed to great envy, trials, and dangers. I remember a great quotation from Charles Spurgeon. Spurgeon's church was huge, especially even for that time in the 1800s. His church was very large, and like 5,000 people would come listen to him preach. And I remember reading a quotation from him where he said, that in the deepest part of his heart, he wished he had a smaller group of people out in the countryside somewhere that he could really attend to their needs and preach to their situations and their needs and not have such huge demands upon him all the time. So the people who were the most gifted were not necessarily the happiest of people. Always remember that, you know, joy is found and a sense of purpose is found just by walking with the Lord and obeying him and pursuing your calling, whatever that is, your vocation, whatever that is, whether it's preaching or otherwise, with your whole heart and doing it for the Lord Jesus and staying focused on him. You know, Martin Luther was asked the question, if you knew Jesus was coming back tomorrow, what would you do? And he said, I would plant an apple tree today. In other words, just do your duties. What am I going to do today? I'm supposed to pick up my daughter. She's doing a babysitting job like 3 minutes that way. She's not driving yet, so I got to go over there and get her, take her back to the house, drop her off, come back here. I'm probably going to put in another hour and a half on sermon preparation. And I'm also getting ready for a conference, doing a conference this weekend on raising the next generation. And I'm doing the final talk, which everyone will be exhausted for, I'm sure, called Rejoice, Have Babies. So I'm excited to preach on that. We'll see who shows up. Okay, listen. Many others have smaller measures of gifts, that God is under obligation to none and may do with his own what he pleases, and that great gifts exposed to great envy, trials, and dangers. Okay. Point number 5. Beware of all appearances of obstinacy or of a stiff and self-willed temper, especially in matters that are in themselves indifferent or doubtful. That's good advice, not just for ministers, but for anybody. You don't want to be self-willed, and you don't want to be hardcore and dogmatic, especially in things that are indifferent and somewhat doubtful. That's a big problem, especially among young men, especially young converts to Reformed theology, can take something that they would never actually try to prosecute anyone in the church for sinning in it, but they'll go to the mat on, you know, something like Christmas trees or you know, driving your car on the Sabbath or you know, who knows what. What I've often told folks, when it comes to matters that are indifferent or it's not like a real strong case can be made for them in Scripture, you need to be real careful about what you say is actually a sin. For example, a lot of Christian people don't have their kids dress up or go out and trick-or-treat for Halloween. We've done it a few times we haven't. This year I'm speaking at a Reformation a bonfire at a sister church down in Greenville, Tennessee. I'm excited to do that. I'm taking my whole family with me. I told the kids, we'll get you some candy. Don't worry about it. We'll make sure you get candy. But it'll be a much more fruitful time for us. Now, there are some people who say, no, Halloween is Satan worship. And if you dress up your kids and go from house to house, you know, then that's satanic. You're worshiping Satan and you should be, you're sinning. And my response is, okay, if you're willing to say that, if you're going to be an elder or a minister of the gospel, you need to put your money where your mouth is. What I mean by that is you need to bring charges, formal charges, against every person in your church that does it. Because if you're going to say it's sin, then it's something that ought to be punishable by the church. Now, most guys are going to kind of back off on that a little bit. Some people will say, I mean, all things Christmas are from Satan. Presbyterians didn't have anything to do with this stuff for 300 years. And if you even put up a Christmas tree in your house and you're worshiping the devil and everything else, and then you kind of press and push them a little bit, would you actually suspend someone from communion for putting up a tree in the living room? Kind of back off a little bit. Listen to Brown again. Beware of all appearances of obstinacy or of a stiff and self-willed temper, especially in matters that are in themselves indifferent or doubtful. I would put every one of those things under the heading of indifferent or doubtful. Okay, we want to apply biblical wisdom and everything else, but you don't want to make everything a hill you die on. Okay, avoid in like manner a contentious disposition, inclining you to contend for things not plainly revealed, or when providence is not calling to contend for them, and there is no ground to hope for edification by it. This is really wise. He's exactly right. Okay, avoid a contentious disposition. Okay, don't be the person who's going to go to the mat and argue and have a knockdown, drag-out fight over every little thing. Okay, one of the things we do here at our church, we have wine and we have juice. Okay, now some people, by conviction, will not consume anything with alcohol in it because they have backgrounds, they have issues, alcohol abuse in their family, or maybe they themselves struggle with alcohol. A lot of times pregnant women, my wife, when she was pregnant, would not take wine in communion because she, you know, had read that wine can hurt the fetus and everything else. I mean, even the teeniest, tiniest little quantity. I wondered, you know, is that actually possible? I think most of the people in the old world probably drank a lot of wine when they were pregnant, and I don't think it really harmed anything, but is that something I'm going to have a knockdown, drag out, like you're apostate, going to hell, disobeying the Lord? Of course not. Okay, of course not. Now, there's no question that the Greek term oinos, wine, and the Hebrew term yayin, wine, refers to a beverage that had fermentation in it. No question about it. But it's not the percentage of alcohol that makes it what it is. It's the fruit of the vine. You can take communion, I think, with grape juice or with fermented grape juice. It's not the alcohol content that makes it what it is. I don't think that's part of its ontology necessarily. But I'm not going to write a treatise about it or like go on a tirade from the pulpit. I'm very thankful we have both. Ever since I got here, I always take the wine. I always take the wine because that's what fits best with my conscience. Frankly, I don't like the way it tastes. The wine does not taste very good. But that's what I do. I'm not going to hold it against anyone. There are folks from different backgrounds that have a difficult time with anything with alcohol in it. I get it. I understand that. But I'm not going to have a knockdown, drag out over it. Some people do. Some people will. And some people would say, you're not even celebrating the Lord's Supper because you don't have something with alcohol in it. Okay. But I wouldn't get into a huge debate like and go on for hundreds of pages with thousands of footnotes over something like that. Okay, 6, never indulge the least approach to or appearance of intemperate anger. I mean anger on account of things not really sinful, but that are merely the involuntary defects of men. Or anger on account of disagreeable events in the providence of God. Or anger that proceeds not from true deliberation, is not kept within due bounds, is not proportioned to the offense, is expressed in an improper manner, or is of undue continuance. This frame of mind darkens and stupefies the understanding, infuriates the passions, unfits the soul for the exercises of religion, renders reproofs useless, involves us in sin and danger, and exposes to dislike, contempt, and hatred. Okay, he's right. You don't want to be a hothead. You don't want to be someone who's always blowing a gasket and getting mad. 7, shun every appearance of or approach to intemperance in eating and drinking, and all temptations thereunto. As you value the honor of God, and the credit of your sacred profession, carefully avoid all approaches to drunkenness, whether in private houses or places of public concourse. Now, that's very wise. Notice what he's saying. He's not saying abstain from everything with alcohol in it. He's saying, look, you need to take special care that no one could ever bring an accusation against you of drunkenness. So you want to avoid all approaches to it. He's not saying avoid alcohol or avoid places where alcohol is consumed. He's simply saying avoid all approaches to drunkenness in private houses or places of public concourse where people just hang out in a bar or something like that. Notice he's not saying don't ever go to bars. He's just saying avoid drunkenness. Avoid intemperance in eating and drinking. Give no countenance to riotous conviviality, which has sometimes given great and just scandal to serious minds. After ordinations and the administration of the Holy Sacrament of the Lord's Supper, occasions when your mind ought to be peculiarly devout and spiritual, such intemperances, suitable only to the heathen priests of Bacchus, will render the mind utterly incapable to discern and penetrate into the things of God. It is a noted mark of false prophets. And listen, he's got some footnotes there from passages of the Old Testament prophets, and is a distemper that can scarce be cured. As before God, I solemnly charge you to resist every inward rising of irregular desire and all unbecoming familiarities with the other sex. That's smart too. Okay? Not just a minister, but really a married man is typically just not going to be friends with women. You're not going to do things and have regular conversation, just friendly conversation. And sure, pastorally, you talk to the women in your church, but you don't have ongoing intimate friendships with women. You absolutely cannot do that. I've heard, Christian men say, "Yeah, my best friend is a woman I work with." That's crazy. You're out of your cotton-picking mind to do something like that. The fact is, once a man's engaged, and certainly once he's married, his relationship with the other gender changes very dramatically. Now he doesn't have friends that are girls anymore. If he had, a bunch of women he used to hang out with or like kind of do stuff together with and everything like that, that all changes. Okay? Criminal indulgences of this kind of, being overly familiar with the other gender grieve the spirit of God, carry away all the powers of the soul with them, stupefy the conscience, weaken and dissipate the judgment, while the least appearance or suspicion of them will render a minister and his ministrations contemptible and detested. In other words, it destroys your credibility in the eyes of the world. If you are a ladies man, or women, tend to gravitate to you, which has never been a problem for me. When you're in your mid-40s, chubby and bald, not a problem. But if you tend to be someone that has a lot of female attention, that's something you have to make sure that does not happen, especially if you're in ministry. I shall in my next recommend to you some of the Christian graces and tempers which are especially becoming in your station and character. In the meanwhile, I am affectionately yours, John Brown. Okay, let's look at the next letter, letter number 3. While you carefully avoid the vices mentioned formerly, and through the Spirit of God mortify the several inward lusts from which they proceed, you must in the same manner study the exercise of every saving grace and Christian temper and practice toward God, your neighbor, and yourself, as taught by the grace of God to deny ungodliness and worldly lusts and to live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present evil world. In the study of holiness and devotion toward God, your saving graces and Christian tempers must, in a lively and vigorous manner, be exercised in knowing, acknowledging, worshiping, and glorifying Him as God and your God in Christ. They ought to be employed in like manner, in receiving, observing, and keeping pure and entire all the instituted ordinances of His worship, in making a holy and reverent use of His names, titles, attributes, ordinances, word, and works, and in improving His appointed seasons of worship, especially His holy Sabbath, in the most lively exercises of it, whether secret, private, or public, earnestly regarding His authority as the chief and intended, and intending His glory as your chief end in all. In regard to your own person, labor to have your heart habitually spiritual, lively, and burning with love and holy zeal, inflamed and constrained by the redeeming love of Christ shed abroad in it, and by the powerful influences of His Spirit dwelling therein. Cherish the deepest humility, meekness, and lowliness of spirit. Study to possess a courageous disposition of mind, and as much hardiness of bodily constitution as possible. This is very convicting to me, because I tend to be somewhat of a sledgehammer, and that's a character flaw that I have. It's something I have to really try not to have. Now, I'm all for being passionate, and I'd never apologize for being passionate and for being forceful in my proclamation of the truth, but you can easily become intemperate in your passion, and anger can often take over, especially in my own heart, and it's sinful when that happens, and that's something I have to be aware of and make sure it doesn't happen. Study a habitual and orderly activity of disposition in resisting Satan's temptations, mortifying your sinful lusts, in regulating your affections as to the objects on which they should be placed, the bounds within which they should be kept, and the due subordination in which they should move. A sluggish and lazy, as well as a timorous disposition, is of infinitely bad tendency in a minister, and may draw upon him the eternal damnation of thousands, and of himself in the most tremendous form. That is a profoundly important sentence. I want to read that again and comment on this. Listen to this. I'm going to highlight it here. A sluggish and lazy, as well as a timorous. Timorous means like a timid and kind of sheepish. A sluggish, lazy, and timid disposition is of infinitely bad tendency in a minister. Okay? There's a tendency to be sluggish and lazy, not to work hard on your sermons and not to study hard. There's also a tendency to be kind of sheepish and not really want to stand up and take the hard stance and like say what needs to be said. That's a real tendency in ministers. And listen to what he says. And it may draw upon him the damnation of thousands. Meaning, if you're a minister of the gospel, you are, by definition, a public figure. Lots of people are watching you, listening to you, and looking to you for wisdom, for guidance. And so you can't be timorous. You need to speak the truth. If you hear the gospel being denied or attacked, you need to call that out. If you know that what you're hearing is false, I don't care who said it, you've got to address it. Okay, it says that, Titus 1, verse 9, that the elder, the bishop, is to exhort with sound doctrine and to refute those who contradict it. Okay, to draw upon himself the eternal damnation of thousands and of himself in the most tremendous form. Study a heavenly temper as having your Savior, Master, and portion in heaven, as employed in walking and bringing others to heaven, and as expecting your infinitely great and gracious reward in heaven. Study universal decency or becomingness in all your words, deeds, gestures, and dress suitable to your office, your age, your gifts, the graces which you ought to exercise, and the circumstances in which Providence has placed you in the Church of Christ. This will render you honest and pious, your honest and pious actions lovely, even to the enemies of your religion. In bearing adversity, especially sufferings for righteousness' sake, study to exercise an earnest and vigorous faith in God's promises, hope of his gracious and seasonable support and deliverance, patience, fortitude, and constancy under his correction, and kindly resignation to it, wisdom and prudence in judging of the troubles and their causes, and in using proper means for removing them. You hear what he's saying? If you're a minister, and you go through something that's really, really, really tough with one of your children or in your marriage or something or in your family or whatever, you've got to rest on God's promises. You have to do what you preach and tell others to do. You need to hope in God's gracious and seasonable support in those times, those seasons of difficult trial. And you need to have patience and courage and resignation to the will of God, wisdom and prudence in judging of the troubles and their causes. You know, don't go, woe is me, and I'm undone, and all everything's against me. Don't be like that. Thus you will attain to the most honorable as well as profitable part of the Christian life, and be fitted for directing and comforting others in their adversity. One thing I will say, if you're a minister of the gospel or are thinking about becoming a minister of the gospel, you will experience hardship, and you'll experience opposition and trials. And that opposition and those trials are there to test you. They're to test your loyalty, to test your resolve, and to test and see, will you cling to the Lord? Because as a pastor, you're going to be telling other people to do that all the time when they go through things that are really, really, really hard in their family and their life and their marriage. You got to cling to Christ, got to cling to the Lord. Well, how can you tell others to do that if you haven't really had to do that a whole lot yourself? And so don't be surprised if, you know, you feel like there's a target on your back when you feel a sense of calling to the ministry. In your family, you ought carefully to choose servants that are prudent and fearers of God. Listen to that. You ought to carefully choose servants that are prudent and fearers of God. Just instead of servants, friends, acquaintances, things like that. But much more circumspection and gracious direction from God are necessary in your choice of a pious, prudent, active, frugal, kind, and affable wife. Exactly. Who may be a help and ornament to you and your family, not a hurt, hindrance, reproach, and grief. In your family, a more than ordinary knowledge of divine things, holiness, devotion, love, harmony, order, and gravity ought to prevail, while you retain your authority over them and prudently provide necessaries for them. You ought to manifest an affectionate delight in your wife. Wow, can't emphasize that one enough. If you're a minister of the gospel, it ought to be as clear as the noonday sun to everyone that knows you that you absolutely, totally, completely dote on and adore and delight in your wife. Sympathy with her in trouble and patient bearing of her infirmities. The children whom God may give you should be brought up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord without either sinful indulgence or cruelty in your dealings with them, and in due time appointed to some proper business answerable to their inclinations, abilities, and station in life. Your servants should have not only proper work and wages, but ought to be carefully instructed along with your children in the principles of religion and required and encouraged to observe the secret, private, and public ordinances thereof. So really, all he's doing is saying your house needs to be in order as well. Now, we're going to get to the theological letters here soon, but he deals with personal piety and personal holiness and personal qualities here initially, because that's what most of the qualifications are about in Titus and 1 Timothy 3 when they address what the elder or the teaching elder or the minister is supposed to be like. Okay, let's see. How long are we into our video here? 26 minutes. Okay, let's just do a little bit more of letter number 4. Let's see if we can do this one. Dear sir, in regard to mankind in general, you must labor to be not only unblameable and unreprovable in all things, but also of good report. Study the most rigid equity in all your dealings. Cultivate the most engaging humility of spirit, preferring others to yourself, condescending to persons of low degree, never esteeming yourself too much, nor reaching beyond your station and ability. Above all things, put on charity, the most tender and loving affection, and abound in its delightful and winning exercise, ardently loving good men in proportion to the appearance of Christ's image in them, highly esteeming them, delighting in their persons and company, readily assisting in their persons and company, readily assisting and supporting them, truly and heartily loving all men, wishing and promoting their real good, pinching yourself to supply the poor, forgiving injuries, though often repeated. That's going to happen to you as a minister. I just want to warn young men that are interested in gospel ministry. Christian people are the sweetest, kindest people that I've ever met in my life. And I'm so thankful for all the encouragement that I've gotten over the years. However, I will say as well, I have gotten some of the nastiest things that anyone has ever said to me, said by professing Christians. I received a letter on the Tuesday following the presbytery meeting where I was sustained in my former denomination to be ordained, and I had waiting for me from an elder in that church the nastiest piece of correspondence I've ever received from another human being in my entire life thus far. And this has been, that was 13 years ago, and to this day I have never received anything more hateful and more full of venom than that in my entire life. And it was shocking. I couldn't, this individual claimed that what he had given me was the wounds of a friend. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. And I think that he really thought that people like myself are dumb enough not to recognize the difference between the wounds of a friend and the flogging of an enemy. Because that's what that letter was. It was unbelievable. Okay, so you need to be able to forgive injuries, though often repeated. There are people who, like, you'll do something that they don't like, and they'll bring it up over and over and over. Every time they get you alone, they'll try to smack you in the face with it. Just got to overlook it. You stand your ground and defend yourself, or defend the truth, whatever it might be, but you just have to forgive, and you move on. Pitying and praying for malicious and inveterate enemies, and rendering them good for evil. That's tough to do. If you are the type that, especially in your former life before you were a Christian, were vindictive and vengeful, that's pretty tough to do that. Pitying and praying for malicious and inveterate enemies and rendering them good for evil. Being hospitable to strangers, especially to such as are persecuted for righteousness' sake, or who appear to be extremely destitute. Let your moderation be known to all men, and readily bearing with, and overlooking their moroseness, passion, imprudence, or the like, interpreting their words and deeds in the best sense that they can bear, yielding from your right to prevent contention and offense, overlooking and forgiving what reproaches and injuries you meet with. Show yourself to be apt, ready, and inclined to things spiritual. Let your speech be always seasoned with salt, not merely innocent, but edifying. Seize every opportunity of introducing or maintaining spiritual converse, meaning conversation. In order to this, furnish your mind with an extensive stock of interesting anecdotes and striking hints. In imitation of your divine master, study to draw something serious and instructive from everything you see or hear. Prudence is no less necessary in guarding against the advances of designing men who hypocritically pretend to esteem and love you. Listen to that again. Prudence is no less necessary in guarding against the advances of designing men who hypocritically pretend to esteem and love you. Really? There's people that will pretend to love you? Oh, yeah. That's happened to me several times. And I've gotten an axe in the shoulder, between the shoulder blades, because of it. So you need to be prudent. You need to be wise about such things. There will be people who will hypocritically pretend to love you, and they don't love you at all. In avoiding the unbridled rage of enemies, I've seen that too. I'm going to highlight that one. In attending not only to that which is lawful, but also to that which is expedient. In keeping within the limits of your station while you are endeavoring to extirpate evil and promote what is good. In never correcting evils by that which will prove as hurtful or more so. In studying to suppress the fame of your good deeds, if it be likely that it will be perverted to a bad use. Okay, don't orchestrate things so that you're recognized for how great you are. Bad idea. Don't do that. And in never meddling with or even inquiring into those things that do not concern you. What's not your business, you'll learn over the years to be happy that it's not your business. By the earnest study of the above duties toward God, yourself, and your neighbor, you will promote your own delightful fellowship with God. You will cherish and maintain abundant influences of the Holy Ghost who dwells in you. You will make God delight to honor and bless your ministrations. You will prevent your falling into much sin, snares, contention, reproach, and the like. You will increase your fitness for your office. You will render yourself and your family noted examples to your flock. You will procure the affection of all good men, the help of their fervent prayers, the esteem of all, and their readiness to attend without prejudice to your instructions, reproofs, and exhortations. You will adorn your ministry and promote the usefulness of it in the salvation of your hearers. You will highly glorify God in acting answerably to his nature, his oracles, law or gospel, ordinances or worshipers with which your ministry is connected, all of which requires holiness and virtue in all manner of conversation. Whereas, by unholiness and vice, ministers render themselves unfit to study, understand, or declare the mysteries of God's kingdom, and are exceedingly hurtful to the church, exposing her ordinances to neglect and contempt. Their bad example spreads far and wide among the people. Their wickedness introduces manifold errors and corruptions into the church. Nothing is more difficult to cure than the heart of an ungodly minister, and their corruptions expose them to the most fearful judgments of the Most High. I am affectionately yours, John Brown. So it's a big deal to take on the office of a minister. But you do need to remember all those things, and you need to remember that your calling is to be a minister of the gospel, and you need to walk closely and carefully with the Lord while you fulfill that calling. Now, I believe we're getting close here to him really here we go. In the next few letters, he's going to really talk more about getting the gospel right and ways to get it wrong. So that's where it really gets much more apropos to the strange things that are going on today doctrinally in so-called reform circles. But anyway, we'll get there next time. Thank you for watching or for listening.
This is Pastor Patrick Hines of Bridwell Heights Presbyterian Church, and you've been listening to the Pulpit Supplemental Podcast. You can find us on the web at www.bridwellheightspca.org. Our sermons are streamed through Sermon Audio, and you can listen to that on the iTunes podcast version of Bridwell Heights Presbyterian Church. Feel free to join us any Sunday morning for worship at 11 a.m. sharp at 108 Bridwell Heights Road in Kingsport, Tennessee. And may the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace.